At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
In association with Viatel Technology Group, IT leaders breathe easy with Viatel Managed Cybersecurity. Viatel.com.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you are very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we'll take a closer look at how music labels are fighting AI. 1 year of Threads, what impact has it made? And as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. If you want to get in touch, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. But I want to start with this.
Through the reeds and the meadows, where the herons dive, her journey's a legend with memories alive. In the heart of the Shannon, her stories unfold, of the nights filled with laughter and the mornings of gold.
Stunning. That is, I feel obliged to instantly say that is not Christy Moore. I heard it for the first time a few weeks ago and it took me a good 40 seconds to realise that fact. But that is a song produced by a platform called Udio. This allows users to go on and create songs in a matter of minutes. You can input certain details, so you'll have heard references to the Shannon perhaps there. You can customize it, so if you wanted a song about a friend or a family member, you can do that. And then you give it direction in terms of style and genre. So that non-Christy Moore song is one of many products it has produced. But in recent weeks, Universal Music Group, Sony Music Entertainment and Warner Records have filed lawsuits against Udio and another platform called Suno, alleging copyright infringement of recorded music at, and this is a quote, an almost unimaginable scale. So how big of an issue are platforms like this, and what does it mean for the artist? My old pal, Tom Dunn, is with me now. Tom, I always enjoy talking to you. As a creative person, what's your take on platforms like Udio and Suno?
Well, not just from a creative person's point of view, but also I'm involved at IMRO, and it is seen as the biggest existential threat to songwriters and copyrighted music, unlike anything else that's ever come down the road, basically. And it's top of everyone's agenda, and the EU has just brought in a bill trying to deal with it, and member states are signing up to that as we speak. So it's absolutely huge. And the general view is, left to its own devices, it could gut the music industry as we know it and just absolutely hollow out all of the great copyrighted works and people's back catalogues and all the money that they've made from them, which the music industry has been running on for the last 100 years, basically. So it's the number one threat, no question about that. And people are looking at it. It's the first thing on every meeting to do with the music business. It's what's it at now? Where does it stand? How has it affected us? It's very much up and running, but where it's going to go to and how it's going to start really impacting still remains to be seen.
One of the counter arguments I've heard in this debate, and I'm going to be devil's advocate for a second, is that, you know, stuff like sampling and heavy inspiration and so on have been within the music industry for a very long time. And if you look at an artist, you know, somebody like Mark Ronson, for example, he's done incredible work bringing music from older artists to younger generations with his sampling. Is there not an argument that this technology is just another version of that? Or is the thinking still that this is very much going to gut the industry and hurt those working in it?
Yeah, I think the scope of it is so much different that's what's really frightening. And I think Also, it is a little bit underhand, and not really a little bit, it's very underhand, because when it arrived first, there was this kind of disbelief where you could say, write a song in the style of Nick Cave, and it would write quite a reasonable song in the style of Nick Cave. And that was even played, one of them, to Nick Cave, who said, yeah, it does sound like me, but there's no heart or soul in it, he said. But then after a while, you realize that the reason it's able to do that is that it's been trained on the entire works of Nick Cave. Somebody has taken all of his music and input it into these AI platforms. Mm. So it's not just in the style of it, it's actually going back to algorithms of his work, copying his chord progressions, his style of lyrics. And it is a Nick Cave song, is what it really boils down to. And there's stories of people going to one of the engines, Udio, and saying, write me a song in the style of Mariah Carey, give it a kind of, you know, her vocal range, make it seasonal, all of those things. And they get it just to, you know, a carbon copy of her Christmas hit. Mm. And that's laughable stuff. But whilst for very big stars like her, everyone's going to cop it, it's further down the road, if it's a lesser known artist, doesn't have maybe huge backup of record companies, you could take a song in the style of one of their songs and then maybe put it in a film or something like that. And then the people making the film wouldn't need to pay any money towards that. Anyone at the film will think it is you, but you're not getting a penny for it. Mm. And then you might be going back to the waitressing job that you tried so hard to avoid.
Yeah, this is something that we've covered a bit here on News Talk over the years. The smaller artists who are absolutely booking gigs and maybe they're playing a stage at a festival and so on, they are hustling hard to make it. This does feel like yet another hammer blow to them.
It does. I think anybody trying to make it or just survive in music, which is where most people are, there's very few huge stars of the level of U2 or Hozier or people like them. Most people are depending on a mix of CD sales at gigs, doing gigs, money from radio plays, all that kind of stuff. So if you see CD sales are gone and then you have this little check that comes in once a year from your collection agency, if that's getting eaten into as well and taken out, then you will be gone. That will be, you know, an absolute groundbreaking event in music. And everyone's aware of it. You know, all the agencies and the record companies, they all know people have to play fair. You can't just take somebody's work and ingest it into an engine. And that goes for everything. It's not just music. It's the same for artwork. And loads of the arts AI platforms are getting sued as well. Or journalism or books. You can't just suddenly, you know, appropriate somebody else's intellectual rights and just pass it as your own. It's too big a threat, I think, is the thing. It's just, it seems existential.
Mm. One thing I'm like genuinely curious about though is, like, is there a way and a world in which the artist benefits from AI services, things like ChatGPT, for example? Like, I'm sure there has to be an artist out there using it as a launch pad or a spark when they're songwriting, because there's no doubt, and we've spoken about it a lot, you know, they are useful tools. As a songwriter, would you have ever dabbled with stuff like that?
You would do little things like that, yeah. And it's funny, you know, there is kind of a human equivalent to this. There are people who are really talented producers who can play every instrument and all that kind of thing. And people will go to them and say to them, I want to write a song in the style of, say, the Bee Gees. And they will know all the kind of chops that the Bee Gees use. And they will write a song in the style of the Bee Gees. And that will be their song. That will be, even though you've taken inspiration from how they've worked, there's no protection for the Bee Gees against that. So that kind of stuff has gone on all the time. But this is people who haven't ever written a note, just sitting down and coming up with very highly derivative songs. And I think there's an action going on at the moment for the Recording Industry Association of America. And they're saying if you want to train on all those copyrighted works, you need to pay a license fee to do it. It's as simple as that. And, you know, if you can come to an arrangement that the people who wrote it initially get recognized and get rewarded for that, then there's no problem. But just taking it and acting like it's yours isn't on.
Mm. Just to explain how it works a little bit, when you play songs on your show here on News Talk, for example, a log is kept of the music that you play, and then that list goes to Imro, the body that you mentioned at the start of this chat, and that ensures that the artists you play get whatever the fee is. We know, because we've spoken about it, that Universal pulled their music library from TikTok, and there was a huge spat over the amount of money the company would pay the label for access to its music library. So there is, I suppose, form and history for debates of this nature, recent history. Is there anything specific here in Ireland that's being done to try and address it, to protect the artists? Because it does seem, you know, at least that this industry, if not many others, is under huge pressure from big tech on a few different fronts.
It is. And the glory here is that people like Universal also have deep pockets. The tech companies have deep pockets, but so too do Universal and Sony and Warner's. And they're making good money from their back catalogues. And they don't want it threatened. So, yeah, the way it works is every time a song gets played on the radio, if you've written it, you get paid for it. And the same is true on TV, or if you're lucky enough to get something synced into a film. And that's true the world over. And those agencies all over the world collect that. And IMRO is a particularly good agency for all of that. So that's what people live on and what they can depend on for the rest of their lives, basically, if they have very big hits. And all of the agencies are looking at what's going on and saying, if you're taking our works, if you're taking work that we represent and that's copyrighted, then you need to pay for that. And they're saying to them, you know, either sign a license deal or there will be problems. And a lot of this is going to be seen as happening on a case-by-case basis. So if somebody suddenly has a hit and somebody can say, I think there's an awful lot of my songwriting gone into that, it can be scanned. You can run that through software and see if indeed it was trained on your music. So that would be a court case, and that would be a very expensive court case for the people who stole the music in the first place, is the only word to describe it.
Yeah, but just for the smaller artist again, like if I am a smaller artist and I have a few tunes, not only am I not making enough money from streaming to sustain me, but if my music is taken and interpreted by AI, I'd have to pay a hell of a lot of money to take legal action and fight to protect what's mine.
You'd have very, very limited options there, unless you've signed a publishing deal with a publisher with deep pockets. And the stories, by the way, are unbelievable. There are people, I know of one traditional Irish musician who discovered that an album in Scandinavia was one of his albums slowed down. So somebody had recorded it, slowed it down, put a new name on it and released it. And it had been a hit as well. So those kind of things happen. There's a certain sense of panic in the business. And I think people, and that's a lot of that is fear, where you just don't know what's going to happen next. And you kind of know that these engines, the songwriting kind of engines that are trained, are going into the hands of people who are 13, 14, 15, who couldn't care less where it's coming from. And who are also very creative. So, and then they might produce something and they might stick it out there, and it then will be sampled and there'll be a second generation copy of that. And the fear would be that as each new generation copy comes out, it becomes impossible to work out where it came from. I don't know where that's going to end, to be completely honest, Jess. And, you know, maybe it'll blow over and that will become a genre of music, which is not dissimilar to elevator music, that it's not as good as the originals, but it'll get you by, that kind of stuff. Who knows? Or maybe it'll be brilliant. Maybe it will be distinctively new.
I remember when I used to work on your show back in the day, we'd often spend time in the afternoon just listening to music. I used to love the afternoons where we'd just be passing CDs back and forth across the desk. And I watched your face light up when you came upon a new artist or track that you love. I always refer back to the first time you heard Gavin James. You were blown away. And I think you had a bit of an emotional reaction. You definitely, like, I could see it, that it, you weren't just like, oh, this is cool. Like you, it struck you in a different kind of way. When you listen to an AI artist or AI produced music, have you ever been tricked by it or drawn in by it? Or are you always able to tell that it's been produced by AI?
So far, everything I've heard, when people have played stuff to me that's an AI version of Oasis, I can hear it's an AI version of Oasis. It's like a bar band. It's got all of the kind of hitting all the right notes, but it just doesn't have any of the soul or the swagger or the intelligence of Oasis. I think they are very easily spotted. And I think if you're able to use AI to that degree, then you probably that you don't recognize, or it sounds new and original, then maybe it's hats off to you. But so far, it's starting from a very derivative place. And what you look for in music is a bit of the person's personality and their soul coming through in it. And people that excite me, like the new Lazarus Soul album next week, only one band could write that music, and it's brilliant. And, you know, I'd hate to think of anything being taken away from them through essentially crooks on AI. But I do think trying to replace the soul in people is beyond AI.
Yeah, it definitely is. So ultimately, is this going to just come down to legislation and legal cases? Like, is legislation the best and possibly only line of defence we have for this at the moment?
It seems to be. And the legislation varies from territory to territory. And in Europe, we seem to have taken a very strong hand with this. And you can't copyright an AI-generated work, for instance. But in other countries, they're taking a different tack. In America, it's much more free and easy. So you may find in a year or two that you're seeing a wave of AI music coming from America and not so much from Europe. And I don't really know how that's going to play out. Maybe it could be great music coming to America. No one knows. It's really, we're in very unknown territory with the whole thing. But I know one thing, people who've written music and who depend on their publishing income are very worried indeed.
Yeah, and I think they're right to be as well, unfortunately. I know we will both be watching the developments in this case and indeed this entire space very closely over the coming months, and we will no doubt be talking about it again. But for now, Tom Dunn, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Before the break, we were chatting to Tom Dunn about AI in music, and I completely forgot to mention this example.
And now and then, if we must start again, well, we will know for sure that I will love you now and then. I miss you.
Isn't that just gorgeous? It makes me happy every single time I hear it. That is Now and Then by the Beatles. But it's safe to say that that would not exist without artificial intelligence. Peter Jackson worked with the Beatles to strip a demo track that John Lennon did to enhance the vocal, remove the piano, and then add in other instruments to build it up. So I guess, you know, AI isn't all bad, but I would love to hear from you. If you are an artist, are you worried about AI, or are you embracing it to create new art? What are you using? How is it going? And are you looking at this as an opportunity? You can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. But we are going to turn our attention now to social media, because on the 5th of July last year, Threads entered the world. It entered part of the world because it wasn't available here in Europe to begin with. But 1 year on, what difference, if any, has it made to the world of social media? Cillian Ginnity from News Talk is with me now. Cillian, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well now, thank you. It's hard to believe it's been a year since Threads. Before we delve into it and whatever it is and will be, let's just go back and rewind the tape a little bit, because Twitter was the king of, you know, live sport, live politics, live news. It's where you went to get the finger on the pulse of whatever was going on. But then when Musk took over, bit by bit, the love for the platform and the trust on the platform seemed to dwindle.
Massively. And part of that is actually even down to how Musk acquired it, because he said he was going to buy it and then he tried to pull out and he says, until you show me how many bots and how many AIs are currently on the platform, I'm not going to buy it. And then he was forced to basically buy it. So that alone kind of put a question mark on the number of actual users that was on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And Twitter was this incredible, what felt like open source news, where as soon as things were happening, you were finding out about it. And the amount of breaking stories that we've all learned about through Twitter, they all started from there, has kind of evaporated, partly because of people leaving the platform. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of normal users left it because they actually turned out to be an increase of certainly more visible bots.
Yeah.
I think we're all getting a lot of them kind of LinkedIn bio, random replies. Then there was also a massive, I think the, not to be hyperbolic, but there was a culling of staff and resources, which then allowed a lot more what most common people would refer to as unacceptable language and speech onto the platform, because it's no longer being monitored in the mm-hmm. same way. And whilst Musk has tried to be a bastion for free speech, he's now also kind of pulled back on that when he realized that advertisers don't want that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he's tried to pull it back, and then as he's called out on it, he then lets that go again. And it's this kind of tussle between one man's whim mm-hmm. and the want and desires of millions and millions of users. And in the end, it's leaving a platform that feels messy, clunky, and practically abandoned by most people that you'd actually talk to.
Yeah, it's very inconsistent. And I think that's the big thing that frustrated me last year. When they got rid of the safety teams, the safety and trust teams, like, that was a huge thing. And I definitely saw a difference in the content that was on the platform, but also the lack of reaction when something was reported. And I'm not just talking about someone saying that, you know, you look like an idiot. It's like vicious content was staying up on the platform.
And complete misinformation as well. There's lots of older videos now from, could have been a war in 2011 in Syria, that's now being reported as if it's from Gaza.
Mm.
So there's now this constant questioning of what can you actually trust.
Yeah, well, I think, to be fair, and you know, I spoke about this with Stephen O'Leary a little while ago, like, I've worked in News Talk for 16 years, and over that time we have covered so many breaking stories, and I've been in here at all hours of the day looking to verify content, and you know, we'd never run with anything until it was completely verified and we were sure of it. But now what's happening on Twitter, or X as I like to be called, is that the amplification of mis and disinformation is off the charts. So it could have just been, say, you putting up something from 2011 saying it's from today.
Yeah.
But now that seems to be presented in the For You page, or the, you know, like the two different tabs. And I find it very difficult as a user to go on and get information that is accurate, that interests me, that's relevant to me, and that I would be bothered seeing. You know what I mean? You have
and
to scrape through.
You no longer have the safety net of being able to trust the blue tick either.
No.
I can, like, pay for that, whereas it used to be that kind of like, okay, if nothing else, I can give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
That's now gone.
But even, like, if you look at the like, obviously we had the UK election this week. We're coming up to a US presidential election, potential one here as well. Like, politicians used Twitter as a tool. Like, I always refer back to Hillary Clinton announcing her intention to run for the presidency on Twitter. She didn't hold a press conference. She took to Twitter. That doesn't happen to the same extent. Like, you still see people like Obama and even the Joe Biden account posting things with their blue tick, but they're also cross-posting on other platforms, or they're engaging with podcasts and traditional media. It's no longer the place where stuff, it's no longer the only place where stuff happens online.
No, and I think that kind of fundamentally comes down to where lots of journalists are, especially mm-hmm. in the political realm. How can you get your news to as much people as possible? And that's kind of been eroded. And like, even now we're seeing a bit like AI and stuff, not to always be harping on about that, but like all these AI videos of, in the UK election, of like Scottish leaders saying things that they actually didn't say.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't quite get that to the same degree on the likes of an Instagram, where things are a little bit kind of more verifiable, a little bit more trustworthy, and a little bit kind of generally lighter. I think there is also kind of a news fatigue
that
has not helped Twitter, and it's kind of pushed people off. Plus, the For You page used to be, I feel anyway, a lot more kind of tailored to what I wanted, and it seems to have kind of been invaded by blue ticks of these random accounts that I don't follow, I don't have any mutuals with, but then suddenly I'm going to see something about crypto. I don't want to know about crypto right now.
Yeah.
I don't follow it here. And I'm sure you're the same, where you kind of segment your interests by the app that you're using. I go to Twitter for this, I go to Instagram for that, I go to wherever for whatever. And that's, they try to be a little bit of everything to everyone, and they've become nothing to a lot of people.
Yeah, I just, I find it, because I left Twitter for a while and I'm back on it the last few months, And I only went back on it because we were doing the mini marathon for the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre and I wanted to use it as an amplification tool for that. And it definitely worked. Mm. But I haven't been on it today, for example. Yeah. And normally I go in and I'll check what's happening. I'll check my app mentions. I'll check my DMs. But it's kind of fallen off the radar a little bit. And when these changes were happening at Twitter, like I was on pretty much every show here talking about what's the new Twitter going to be. And there was an awful lot of talk about Mastodon at first. Yeah. And I'll be completely honest and hold my hands up. As a tech journalist, I couldn't figure out how it worked. I didn't understand it. It was
putting in the server and all that kind of stuff. It was just a little bit, it was not, the entry level for that was beyond most people.
Yeah.
You had to have an understanding of kind of slightly the bones of how a social media platform works. It was kind of like having a Microsoft Teams or a Slack, but for everybody. Mm. You had to know how to join that. And it just had all the best intentions. And everybody, there was a massive surge to it.
Yeah.
And its platform wasn't that bad, but it just kind of gave the impression of too small to be able to support what people wanted. And I think it kind of ended up being a blip on the map because of that. I know there's still a lot of kind of users on it and it seems to be a generally nicer place than Twitter was towards the end.
Mm.
But I think fundamentally they just didn't have the money that, say, some of the other new Twitters did to be able to kind of compete.
And I think like the point you make about the first engagement you have with an app, if you get a headache when trying to sign up to have the crack online, you're going to walk away. And I just think I did eventually get set up and all the rest, but it always felt that little bit clunky to me. And it wasn't the seamless. You could tell that it didn't have the money of the Threads or the Blue Skies or the whatevers. So that did die a death. Then Jack Dorsey, and I actually forgot about Blue Sky until you mentioned it a minute ago, but Blue Sky started hanging around. But they made the mistake, and I will stand over this forever, of making it too exclusive.
They tried to do what Bebo did when Bebo tried to come back, where you sign up.
And it didn't work.
Yeah. But it was like one of these kind of things, you sign up and then you will eventually get invited to it. And it was meant to kind of, I think, partly not have the problems of the likes of a Mastodon where they couldn't grow too quickly, so that when you are getting there, it will be a nice experience. But what ended up happening was most people forgot.
Yeah.
And then like 3 months later, you get an email. Like, I forgot I had a Blue Sky account until like last week when they sent an email going, oh, you can now invite more people. And because you're inviting them, they will get accepted. And I was kind of like, well, that's not the point of social media.
Yeah.
People want to join a social media to join it. Like every click is an opportunity to click away. And putting an email and waiting is an opportunity to click away forever. And I kind of think Blue Sky has done that. And again, it kind of had a similar kind of thing to the Mastodon, where it was something about servers and all these kind of little bits. There was just an extra step beyond what people were kind of comfortable in doing.
Yeah.
Whereas Threads became so simple to sign up to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, if Twitter had never existed and if it was just Mastodon, obviously everyone would have just gotten on board with it. But we're kind of spoiled brats.
Absolutely.
Where you just put in you want to just create a username, put in an email, create a password and be in. Like, you don't want to faff around. And so that is absolutely, I think, a design flaw on both of those platforms. But Threads kind of came, there was rumors for a while that Meta would do something of this ilk. Eventually it happened. So on the 5th of July last year, Threads appeared in the App Store outside of Europe. It wasn't allowed launch here. And there was quite a bit of buzz about it, you know, because we thought, a lot of us thought, you know, we do want somewhere for that instantaneous sharing of news and updates. Doesn't need to be picture-based, so Instagram isn't the right fit. Logically, there should be something else. Can you remember the initial buzz about Threads?
Yeah, absolutely. So I work in social media, so obviously I'm going to be slightly biased in this. So it was a big thing. And I believe they got in and around 100 million signups in the first couple of days, which was the fastest growing app ever at the time.
Mm.
So it was fantastically buzzed about. And then I think the fact that the EU's and Facebook's interesting relationship.
Contentious, yes.
Yeah. That didn't allow it to come here kind of slightly added to the buzz, where people are kind of going, oh, what's this thing that we're not allowed? And I know plenty of people, including myself, got VPNs to try and get around it. And if nothing else, claim your account for when it comes. It's going to come. And I think what kind of slightly went against them in the sense that was it took too long to come into Ireland for us to kind of, the buzz had died down.
Yeah, it was like 6 months, 5 or 6 months later, wasn't it? It was December.
And it was to very little fanfare.
Yeah.
Like there was no kind of big deal being made of kind of like Threads has arrived.
Mm.
And I think part of that is Threads struggles with an identity crisis.
Mm.
It doesn't really know what it is. People want a new Twitter. They don't want to be a new Twitter. They like the, one of the most popular threads on Threads is their journalism and news. But that's not what they're seeking.
Yeah, like, they want
as
to
be, a platform, they want it to be lighter. They want it to be closer to Instagram than Facebook. And it's not really working in the sense that like there is creators on there that are complaining that they're not getting enough reach. And part of that is, well, maybe you're just not creating content for that.
Mm.
So you end up with these kind of weirdly, I don't want to say viral, but Threads viral, that level, which is a very different metric. But they end up being these kind of like LinkedIn style one-off posts where it's all a little bit kind of like out of the blue and odd. There's very little kind of, you're not given a personality to things. And then the other thing, which I think so far has been a glorified death knell for them, is Meta, for this is really nerdy stuff now. So behind the scenes of Facebook and Instagram, there's Meta Business Suite. That's how most brands run their things.
Mm-hmm.
And Threads isn't on that. So you can't schedule posts. You can't really do brandy things. So if you have an account, you're the one that's logged into it. So like you can't be logged into multiple accounts on the one device. So if I'm working for News Talk and I'm doing the News Talk one, well then I either have my account on the phone or I have News Talk's one, not both.
Oh.
There's these little things that like it's not encouraging publishers.
Why is that? Because they don't want it, because they want to keep it light, or?
There's been no explanation for it. Now, one of the things they have done, which kind of gives me a little bit of hope, is on the desktop app, do you remember TweetDeck?
In the day.
Yeah, so you used to be able to like compose tweets, be able to have follow your For You page, be able to follow a hashtag or anything like that. You kind of cultivate this little kind of space for yourself to keep up with everything. Threads on desktop is like that now.
Mm.
You can have these little lists and kind of build up the like what you want to be seeing. So it kind of gives you a little bit of hope that they're going in the right direction.
Yeah.
They are making these updates rapidly. There's constant little changes. 2 months ago, there was just a little kind of aesthetic change that made it feel a little bit more premium. Makes it feel a little bit more like an Instagram version of Twitter.
Mm.
Little things like that. So they might do it, but until they incorporate it into the rest of like the business suite, I think they're going to struggle to attract the likes of news publishers, the likes of kind of like social accounts that rely on teams and teams of people to be putting out content. And maybe that's not what they're looking for. Maybe they are looking for something more individualistic, but that's generally the backbone of most platforms, brands.
Yeah. And look, they don't have advertisers and all the rest. Like I'd say we're just at the beginning of this story, but I think because Twitter is such a hot mess, people are actively looking for Threads to get to the level where they want to spend time on it. I signed up and initially I loved that, you know, people who followed me on Instagram could follow me on Threads. I loved that kind of ease, even though I know that the DPC wasn't wild about it. But I do think from a user point of view, it was just a nice touch.
It populated a feed for you instantly. You weren't on like the likes of a Mastodon or a Blue Sky where you're just like, who do I follow?
Yeah, it was all there and it was kind of my people already. But now the only time I really open Threads is when Instagram prompts me to. So, you know, you get the little notification of you've got 27 new updates or whatever. And then when I click in on that and I see that the people, like the notifications are just people following me. Like, so they've obviously just signed up to Threads. They're all Instagram followers. They're not actually engaging with me. And then I look on the posts and that thing that you said, the kind of LinkedIn style personal post, like every time I click in, it's a woman whose husband has left her and she's got 5 tips to overcome loneliness. And you're just like, what?
It's all a little bit kind of like, what if you typed in AI, what should I do for social media posts?
Yeah.
It's a little bit kind of
clickbaity kind of
paint by numbers of social media. Like, how do I get this? And like on my one, I get a lot of kind of like social media, like here's how to engage users. And it's all these kind of like borderline self-help style stuff.
Where it's all like, self-helpy.
Believe in yourself.
Yeah.
Be consistent. Be this, be that. And I think fundamentally, as I said earlier, it has an identity crisis. You go to Instagram because you want to see nice photos and you want to see your friends mm-hmm. on the likes of stories. You go to Facebook because you're of a certain age or you're trying to find, usually to connect with people, I find, more so than anything else. And it can be quite good for content or longer form videos. YouTube, videos, longer form. TikTok is for whatever your algorithm's giving you that week mm-hmm. and people sign up for that. Twitter still is good at having the instantaneous updates because
yeah.
you have that the for you and you have the feed. And the feed is what's happening right now. So whoever you follow, it just keeps populating with the latest tweets. Mm. Threads are trying to find the middle ground between having the Instagram style. We will give you what you want when you want it. So it might be a couple of days before you actually see a post, mm-hmm. but it's going to be best placed to give you the engagement. But it doesn't have the instantaneousness of having like to the second.
Yeah. Update.
So it has it like you'll have it within the hour.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're watching a football match, or if you're like right now with the UK election that's going on, if you're trying to find out what's happening in a certain constituency, well, then you're going to be behind it on threads. So as a user, where's the encouragement to be there?
Yeah, I do think the identity crisis point, I think, is such a solid one because like we're all given out that we're time poor and we all have more apps on our phones than we need and that we could possibly use in a day. And so I, the user, need to be getting something from it and I need to know what I'm getting from it. So like Instagram is, I don't really do TikTok anymore. I have to leave the app from my phone because it's just not good for my soul. But like I could still waste the exact same amount of time on the Instagram reels.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I know what I get when I go to Instagram. Twitter, again, if I have something that I want to push out, which I know sounds very transactional, but that's how it is, chicken. I go to there. Facebook, I check in with every now and then, just sure, why not?
Mm.
But threads, I just don't know where it sits in my media, in my social media diet. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And like, it's another one of these things that like, it hasn't fully embraced images. It hasn't fully embraced video either. And like, even LinkedIn is bringing in a TikTok style video feed.
Yeah.
So if everybody else is doing this, and including Facebook, like Facebook have dedicated teams and staffs for live videos now, and like even on Facebook now they have a gaming section for just video feeds. Everywhere else is doing it, so why aren't you? Is always kind of a question with this. And like traditionally in social media, like the best idea wins.
Mm-hmm.
Snapchat had stories. Instagram now has stories, and people would nearly forget that Snapchat was the one that had it initially.
About Snapchat, yeah. Loads of people still use Snapchat.
Snapchat is absolutely massive, and it's also a very good money turner.
Oh, really?
So the likes of the New York Times and stuff have very, very large subscriber bases for basically just getting like instantaneous news that links to articles. So it's very kind of headline-y, but it's with images. There's lots of really, really clickbaity articles, but like for every tree that you go through, you get an ad. So there is a place for grown-ups on Snapchat. It's not just filters and all these kind of things. But again, it has a purpose. It's instantaneous messaging via images. And again, Threads doesn't encourage you to reply, doesn't necessarily encourage you to message people. I'm not sure if there even really is a feature for that.
I find it all very problematic and clunky.
But apparently they have 175 million users now per month.
Mm-hmm.
So what my question of that would be is like on your Instagram feed, when you're scrolling, sometimes you get the little kind of like snippets of a piece and you might click into that. Is that now, am I now a monthly user?
Yeah, well, I'd imagine so.
So it has people there, but people aren't staying. So it needs to find a reason to keep people.
Mm-hmm.
And until they either change how their algorithm works and make it a lot more for you, a little bit more TikTok-y in the sense that it understands if you're lingering on a post that you're actually interested in that.
Yes,
you don't need
to
always be engaging. And I think right now it's very engagement-led. And I don't know about you, but I rarely like things.
Yeah, no, same.
Yeah, and it's not because of the Elon Musk hiding likes thing. I don't mind if somebody sees what I like. I just
can't be arsed.
Yeah.
Mm.
Or I'm not going to comment on it or anything like that. Like even with Twitter in the old days, you would retweet something and it may not be because you agree with it, but more just to kind of amplify that this is what's happening. On Threads, it feels a little bit more kind of like I'm putting my name to this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just in a really, really weird microcosm of people that are into social media trying it, journalists feeling like they need to be there, brands populating it sort of just so that they have a brand there in case it takes off. And I think for the general user, there's no encouragement to, one, take part and post, which then leaves you with what? A half-filled feed by brands and journalists that you normally like, but they're not, they have no encouragement to keep it going. You're not doing it to share to your friends because your friends aren't there. I have hope for it because they are updating it constantly.
Yeah.
And apparently they are increasing the size of their team. So their team right now is a fraction of the size of an Instagram, a fraction of the size of a Facebook. If they're expanding that, new ideas, new features, maybe there could be hope for them, 175 million users, to be active users rather than being like
monthly.
Yeah.
Passive users. Yeah. If you are a Threads fan, let me know. You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. Or is there another platform that we should all migrate to? I must download Snapchat again on my phone. But again, do let me know, techtalk@newstalk.com. Killian Ginnity, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Yeah, you are very welcome back to the final part of the show. We're going to delve into the inbox in just a quick second to answer your tech questions. But first, John Fardy is here to tell us what's coming up on this week's Screen Time. John, what's on the agenda?
Hi, Jess. Well, this week on the show, I'm talking to legendary Irish director Neil Jordan about his fascinating new memoir, Amnesiac. And it has a lot of very interesting incidents from his filmmaking career and his life in general. A really bright, well, I guess you'd call him up and coming, but he's probably arrived, Aina Hardwick. People will know him playing Paul Mescal's best friend in Normal People. He's certainly on the rise. He's BAFTA nominated. And he's in a great new Irish movie called The Sparrow. And of course, we've all the week's new movie releases in the company of Chris Wasser. Thank you, Jessica.
Great stuff. All of that is on the way in just a few minutes' time. But let's answer some questions, shall we? As ever, if you have a question for me, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. First up, we have David, who says, hi, Jess. Just wondering, have you any thoughts on what is best of iPad, Remarkable 2, Kindle Scribe, etc.? Thinking of investing in one, but getting more confused with all the reviews I'm reading. David, I don't blame you because there's an awful lot of noise out there. And I think they all do in and around the same thing. So if you clearly want something that is good in terms of handwriting recognition to take notes. I haven't reviewed the Remarkable 2, but I know quite a few people who bought them. One of my friends in particular bought one because he'd taken an awful lot of notes, had tried different methods, and bought the Remarkable, liked the handwriting recognition, but kind of found that it was a one-trick pony a little bit. Now, obviously it is. It's designed to do that one thing, but they're a little bit expensive. And for a little bit more money, you could get extra functionality if that's something that you need or want. But in terms of the fundamental thing of note-taking, the Remarkable 2 is very good. The Kindle Scribe is quite similar as well, in terms of being, I suppose, focused on that one element. What I would recommend, and if you are, like you said, the word invest in your email to me, I personally recommend an iPad and an Apple Pencil and an app called GoodNotes. You can also use OneNote if you use Microsoft as part of your working life. But I am a huge fan of the Apple products. I know that's a bit of a U-turn from where I used to be, but I have an iPad mini, I have an Apple Pencil, and I have GoodNotes, and I just find it so great. I find it really easy to set up and to interact with. I can scribble down my notes, I can convert the handwriting to text, but also then I get the extra functionality of having a tablet, of having the iPad be an iPad. So I can do my emails, I can read my books, I can watch videos, I can go on social media, I can use it as a work tool beyond just a digital notebook. And I would highly recommend it. The only thing I would say to you is if you do go down the iPad route, spend an extra few quid and get a paper-like screen protector. I bought one on Amazon. I know people don't love Amazon, but it was the only place I could find one and I needed one quickly. But I bought a paper-like screen protector and it just creates a little bit of resistance between the Apple Pencil and the screen and it feels like you're writing on paper. And it, like I have to say, it's very, very impressive. So as I said, I have the iPad mini. I did have the iPad Pro, but my boyfriend stole it from me and he now uses it to watch sport on. But the iPad Mini is a great size. It's very portable. You can just chuck it into your backpack and away you go. Battery life on it is great. And it's kind of like a little bit bigger than an A5 notebook, but it does the job for me. So of the options you've listed, I would recommend the iPad because it's like a multi-purpose device rather than just the Remarkable 2 or the Scribe, which are purely digital notebooks. So I do hope that helps, and let me know what you go for. Next, we have an email here from Paula. She says, which earplugs did you recommend for sleeping, please? I use the yellow foam ones every night for total sound blocking. So Paula, this is about the chat I had with Ivan Yates on the Pat Kenny Show on Tuesday. So I bought the Loop Quiet 2. That's what they're called. So they are small silicon earbuds. They go into your ear and they block out sound. So you can get different kinds of ones. So if you go onto the Loop website, I bought directly from the Loop website, and the ones that I bought were 20 quid. I bought them primarily for the office. So the Newstalk office, I love it. I love what I do, but it can be a bit noisy at times. So I bought the Quiet 2 because the noise reduction rating is 14 decibels when you use them as directed. So that to me was ideal because it meant it wasn't total noise blocking. I could still hear, like if someone called me, I'd absolutely hear it, but it just muffles everything. There are other ones that you can get specifically for sleep that would be total noise blocking, and you can get ones for live events and for entertainment and all that kind of stuff. But Loop is the brand. I would highly recommend them. I find them so comfortable. I wear them all day now. The ones that I got, so the Loop Quiet 2, when I leave the office and if I'm walking to the Lewis, I can still hear cars and I can still hear, you know, if someone comes up behind me on an electric scooter or anything like that, I can hear the environment noise, but it's just not as loud and distracting and a bit overwhelming as it was without them. So again, head over to the Loop website. You can see this one specifically for sleep. I sleep with the Quiet 2s on and they do the job for me. Again, it's just the muffling of sounds rather than total noise blocking. So I hope that helps you. And finally, for this week, we have an email here from Mairead, who sent me a lovely email. So thank you so much for that. But your question is, I've started a small business this year and still haven't got a laptop. And I've booked a couple of online courses, so using my phone is just not on. I'm not too bad when it comes to using computers. It's just that when I was working, someone else did all the setting up. I completely understand. So I wonder, have you any advice on which laptop will be best in your opinion? And how difficult is it setting up my email account? Can I still access them on my phone? I was so used to it on a desktop. I would like one with a decent sized screen and a mouse. Okay, Mairead, firstly, best of luck with the business. It's a very exciting time. Don't let the tech be a scary thing at all. It's going to be a tool that you'll use for your business and you will breeze through the setup. It's not going to be arduous at all. When it comes to the laptops, the fact that you like a larger screen, so you can get either a 15-inch or a 17-inch laptop screen, they probably will be a little bit more expensive for the bigger screens. But Dell and HP and Lenovo would be brands that I would look at. In terms of the setup, so when you access your email, you will absolutely be able to still get them on your phone. There's no issue at all. So if you're using Microsoft Outlook, if you have paid for Outlook, if you have access to Microsoft Office, it's simply a case of putting in your username, so your email address and your password. If it's a Gmail address, it's the exact same thing. You go to gmail.com and log in. So whatever email provider you have, you go to that website or you can add it to the Mail app, but it's not arduous at all. Also, if you go into one of the big tech retailers here, they have really helpful staff who will set up the laptop for you and put in whatever it is that you need to put in. But don't be overwhelmed or intimidated by it. It's not going to be stressful at all. If you do have any other problems, you can drop me an email again, and I will do my best to help you. But this is one of those things that you'll do it once. So once you set up the email on the new laptop, that's it. You won't have to ever do it again. You won't ever have to worry about it again. If you are a bit apprehensive about it, as I said, tap into the support of the staff in a tech retailer here. Like, there are so many brilliant people working in those stores. I'm sure they'd only be too delighted to help. But yeah, best of luck and let me know how it goes. But that's it from me this week. If you have a tech question for me, drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. I'll be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's Newstalk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.